This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest once answered the following ad in the Village Voice. Attractive young woman wanted for nurse role play and domination. No experience necessary, good money, no sex. Melissa Febo spent 4 years as a professional dominatrix in Manhattan. Her memoir about the experience, called Whip Smart, is now out in paperback. It may be the first dominatrix memoir that mentions growing up listening to NPR, but Phoebos was probably not your typical dominatrix. During those 4 years, she put herself through college and got accepted to Sarah Lawrence, where she went on to receive her Master of Fine Arts in Fiction and Nonfiction Writing. She's now an assistant professor of English at Utica College. Her memoir offers a fascinating glimpse into part of the sex industry and into the world of sexual fantasy and role-playing. It should be pretty obvious by now that this conversation is probably not appropriate for children. Terry spoke to Melissa Phoebos last year. Phoebos began with a reading from her memoir, a description of the so-called dungeon where she showed up for her job interview.
It was like a movie set, an atmosphere truly designed for fantasy, more lush than I had even remotely imagined. It occupied the entire floor, comprised of a maze of dark hallways. Along these halls were the polished doors of a highly styled big-budget dream. Think David Lynch. Excitement folded through me in waves. I had to work there. Behind three of those doors were the official dungeons, the red room, the black room, and the blue room. Accordingly colored, these rooms were huge. The blue room was easily 700 square feet, and all with 10-foot ceilings. The red and blue rooms have full baths, Fiona explained as she pushed open the bathroom door in the red room. She circled the marbled floor, pointing out amenities. These towel racks are heated, so they need to be unplugged after sessions. All the sinks should have scope, Dixie cups, and these little packages of disposable toothbrushes and paste. I traced her steps, lingering over the miniature tube of Crest in its sealed package like takeout dinnerware, and running my hand along the warm towels as I followed her back out into the red room. "That over there is the bondage table," she said, indicating a waist-high bed with leather upholstery and metal rings intermittently hung around its edges. "The top is a lid that opens." "For storage?" I asked. "For slaves. It doubles as a coffin." "A coffin?" "For clients into sensory deprivation. If you're lucky, you get to tie them up, gag, blindfold, the works, and stick them in there for most of the session." She shrugged. "It can get worked into role-play scenes, too."
Okay, that's Melissa Phoebos reading from her memoir, Whip Smart. Now, people will be really curious. You know, you graduated from college while you were a dominatrix. You got accepted to Sarah Lawrence College's MFA program while you were a dominatrix. So why were you choosing to do this work? Was it for money? Did it fulfill your fantasies? Why did you?
Oh, that's a huge question. I mean, ostensibly, when I started, I believed that I was in it for the money. And because I had always known I wanted to be a writer, and as I was approaching graduation in college, I was really faced with the reality that there isn't, you know, an illustrious publishing future awaiting you upon graduation. And so I had sort of investigated the different jobs ancillary to writing, working in publishing, in magazines, assisting an agent, and none of those, it turned out, really had anything to do with writing. And so in my mind, that was my impetus for becoming a dominatrix. But, you know, I had also always been drawn to extremity and to fantasy. And so it really appealed to me on that level as well.
In the reading that you did, you started to describe three of the rooms in the dungeon where you worked. I want you to continue that description. You gave a little bit of the description of the bondage room. There were a lot of things hanging on the wall in the bondage room. Why don't you describe what else was in there?
Well, pretty much all of the dungeons were outfitted with some sort of, coat rack-related thing that had all sorts of floggers, riding crops, a lot of equestrian equipment. gets commandeered for S&M practices. There was always some kind of trunk or container with a stock of rope. We had giant coils of rope in our utility closet, like thousands of feet that we would just cut off when you needed it. There were gas masks and cages and a big hanging Inquisition style cage in the Red Room. And there were mirrors along all of the walls, and they were really vast, you know, and with all of the walls and the ceilings painted, and it had a very specific effect. I think I described it early in the book as sort of being inside of a kind of womb. And, you know, we were right in the middle of Midtown Manhattan, and yet being in those rooms just felt like being at a total remove from the rest of the world, which I guess was the point, because we were there to sort of create fantasy, you know, and you could really sort of invent the world when you're in a place that feels that remote from everything else.
Now, one of the rooms was the feminization room. What was that room for?
The cross-dressing room. Yeah, this was probably the least intimidating of the rooms. It looked kind of like an old-fashioned dressing room or a sitting room. There was a big leather couch and an oriental rug and a vanity with a mirror and a huge supply of cosmetics and hairbrushes and this giant wardrobe. And when you opened the wardrobe, it was literally bursting with giant dresses, giant high-heeled shoes and stockings and undergarments and French maid costumes and all of these man-size, very typically girly feminine clothing. This was actually the room where we had a lot of downtime in the dungeon, because we only worked if clients made appointments and came in. And so I actually spent a fair amount of time in the cross-dressing room doing my homework. And we had these wrestling mats, because that's also not an uncommon fantasy. And I would sometimes drag the wrestling mats into the cross-dressing room and do yoga in my downtime or take a nap on that couch.
When you were watching really large men get into their women's costumes in the feminization room, I'm assuming that these are men. I mean, were these men who were closeted drag queens, or they closeted gay men, or are they just men who have this little place in their mind that's just reserved for this obsession with female clothing, and it's very compartmentalized and it doesn't kind of carry over in the rest of their life? Like, what was your take on the men who would come in for that room?
I think really all of the above, you know. I mean, I think that there's sort of human behaviors that can be – that manifest in a really uniform way, but people arrive at them from all different locations in their psyche, in their experience. And so there was really a pretty wide variety of motives, I think. I mean, some of these men, I think, couldn't really be classified as – I mean, technically they could be classified as cross-dressers, but a lot of them, I think, had developed this sort of obsession or fetish for typically feminine practices, really out of a desire for some kind of intimacy. And some of them would just come in and want to play dress-up and want to have someone brush their hair or just to experience a kind of tenderness. And this seemed like an obvious way for them to access that. And there was really a kind of sweetness sometimes in those sessions. Like, I really felt compassion for some of those people. And for some of them, it was really a purely sort of erotic experience. But a lot of them, it was sort of this very compartmentalized part of their psyche and their lives. And you would never have been able to pick who these people were out of a lineup in their street clothes. Never.
So the standard image of the dominatrix is a woman like wearing, say, a leather corset, fishnet stockings, like spike thigh-high boots with a whip in her hand.
Mm-hmm.
Was that you?
Many days, yes, that was me. But I had a pretty large wardrobe of costumes. It calls for a lot of costumery, that job. But I think that also what goes along with that sort of iconic image of the dominatrix is cruelty, right? And mm-hmm. and sort of a disdain for men, maybe for everyone. And that sort of characterization really didn't fit me and didn't fit most of the women whom I worked with either.
But that was your role, wasn't it? To be the dominant force, men to submit and to say hateful things to them, to verbally abuse them.
You know, it was, but there were so many roles that I played. And that was one of the surprises of that job, that it wasn't just about being the mean bully. That was a big part of it. I did play that role a lot. But really, I acted out just about every typically feminine role that you can imagine. There was a lot of nurturance involved, and a lot of, you know, a lot of people came there to be abused in some ways, but to be in the presence of someone who's powerful and to submit to the control of another person in this context, it didn't always include nastiness or cruelty or humiliation. A lot of times it did, but a lot of times they wanted to just to trust someone else, to sort of hand the reins over to someone else. And in a lot of the scenes that I would play out, I would end up being very nurturing and reassuring and just in control.
How strange was it to tie people up, people who wanted bondage as part of what they were paying for? I mean, that just has to be a really, particularly when you're first doing it, it has to be a really crazy, odd, kind of creepy experience.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the experiences were, and, you know, this is one of those jobs, I think, like a lot of, probably a lot of people in the medical industry have this kind of experience, or maybe even people in sports too, but you work very, very closely with human bodies in a way that most people don't. It's very intimate. And when people are paying to be put in this position and make themselves really vulnerable, they do give you a kind of power. And that was sort of a clumsy position for me to be in at first. And it made me really nervous. And it wasn't always a power that I wanted, you know, but I was also fascinated and kind of mesmerized by it. But yeah, tying up another person is a bizarre experience. Most people don't have that experience, I don't think.
What are some of the costumes that you wore?
Well, the one that you talked about before, sort of the typical iconic dominatrix outfit with the corset and garters and fishnets and stilettos. But I also had a handful of nurse uniforms, some of them sort of sexy nurse Halloween costume style, but some of them really authentic. We used to get a lot of our clothes sort of at actual medical supply stores. And people are actually surprised. I did another interview recently where the interviewer asked me where my favorite boutiques for shopping for equipment were. And actually Home Depot was one of my favorite outlets.
What would you get there?
A rope and clamps and rubber gloves. And it's amazing how many everyday materials get commandeered for uses that most people don't even know exist. But I also had a certain uniform, sort of a police officer-esque uniform, schoolgirl uniform. I definitely had sort of a little suit, a secretary outfit, school teacher outfit. Pretty much any sort of typically female-dominated occupation or role, whatever outfit is associated with that, somebody in the dungeon would have. Probably a lot of us would.
Could you describe, I'm not sure if there's something that you could describe as a typical session, but describe what a session was like. You know, just a concise overview of what a session was.
Sure. I mean, you know, actually what comes immediately to mind, funnily enough, is I recently, you know, I teach writing now and I've done that for a while. And I recently lectured about plot in storytelling. And a lot of sessions actually sort of follow a very traditional plot structure where there will be an inciting incident where we'll sort of be acting out this scene and the client will be playing a role. Sometimes it's of a little boy. Sometimes it's an employee. Sometimes it's a boss. We're in some kind of scene. And there'll be an inciting incident. They'll do something. And then I'll sort of play the powerful role and they've eaten some junk food and I caught them, or I caught them looking at pornographic magazines or something like that. And then the conflict sort of rises. And then there's some sort of climax to the scene where it breaks or pivots and they really give in. And sometimes they'll cry at this point or they'll get punished at this point. I end up forgiving them or comforting them, or there's some kind of resolution.
And did these scenes come with sexual release for the man in the scene?
Sometimes that wasn't required. I mean, and sometimes it was specifically denied, but sometimes, yeah. They would take care of that themselves.
What kinds of men became clients where you worked? I'm sure there was a variety, but what can you generalize about the men who paid to see a professional dominatrix?
I mean, it really was a pretty eclectic bunch, our patrons at the dungeon. But if I have to generalize, I would say that there were a lot of sort of Wall Street types. I mean, it's not a cheap hobby to have.
How so not cheap usually, is it? What's a session?
Well, a session at the dungeon, our clients would pay $200 for an hour session, and the dom would get $75 of that. And usually there's a tip involved. When I went sort of freelance on my own, then there was more of a sliding scale, and I would pretty much charge what I thought that the client could afford.
Melissa, I think all of our listeners will be wondering, like, what is this legal? You know what I mean? Like, is this an illegal operation or is it legit?
You know, it is legal, but I mean, things get a little murky, I think. I mean, my line when I was working was always, if anyone comes and busts us, it'll probably be the IRS, because a lot of money goes in and out of dungeons, and I don't remember filling out any tax forms. But there is no actual sex that happens in the dungeon. And so, you know, it could be classified almost as a kind of therapy. We really just acted out scenes. Most of us kept our clothes on. And so it's not illegal. But, you know, there were certain things that would happen in sessions that probably would flirt with that line. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know exactly. But there were definitely certain, we were definitely encouraged to keep things on the conservative side the first time we saw a client.
Until you could trust them so that they wouldn't bust, you know, turn you into the police or something?
Mm-hmm. Although, you know, plenty of our clients were actual police.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. But they were off duty when they came to see us.
You know, I'm thinking for some of the clients, it was probably not unlike going to a doctor or a therapist in a way, because you've got this secret life, this secret part of you that you can't share with anybody, so you go to a paid professional and reveal it to them. Whether that secret thing, I mean, in a doctor's office, that secret thing might be, a growth or, you know, something happening in a private part of your body. That secret thing might be a genuine secret that you'd share with a therapist, but you wouldn't tell the people you're close to. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that kind of comparison, that people were coming with a secret part of their life that they could only share with a paid professional?
Absolutely. I definitely do. I was actually surprised after I started working at how sort of perfunctory a lot of people were about it. It was like their weekly checkup or their weekly session with their therapist. And it was just a built-in part of these men's lives. And to a lot of them, it was just as essential as a checkup with a doctor or a session with a therapist. And for some of them, I think that it was as helpful as those. For some, not so much. For some, I think it was, you know, I mean, we sort of assume, and it's been my experience, that when I go to see doctors and therapists, that I can rely on sort of a forward progression, that I'm growing or healing or learning more. And that was true for a lot of my relationships with my clients, but not for all of them. For many of them, it was a pretty repetitive experience. It would be like going to the doctor and getting the same information every time you saw them.
What would the equivalent of growing or getting healed be?
I mean, I think that some of them, I would get a client who was new to it and had maybe had a private obsession that they were ashamed of for a long time. And then they would come in and after a year in the job, just nothing will surprise you. You've heard it all before. And so they would come in and I would not be shocked at their fantasy, and we would act something out and they would leave just glowing, you know? I mean, I think that a lot of people are very lonely. Secrecy is a lonely experience. I know that for myself, you know? And so a lot of these people would have been carrying around this sort of obsession or interest or fantasy for a long time, feeling as if they were the only one who'd ever had it, you know? And feeling privately really alienated from other people. And then they would come in and I wouldn't gasp or be shocked or disgusted or reject them. And it would be like, okay, that's fine. I would just treat them like a normal person because in that context they were. I mean, in any context, you know, they were. No one, I think, is really as weird as they think they are. And so for a lot of them, it was really liberating. And for me, there was really parallel experience for me because, you know, for a lot of this experience, I was an active drug addict. And I think that there are a lot of parallels. There's a lot of secrecy. There's a lot of shame. There's a lot of feeling sort of terminally unique. And then when you find other people who have had this experience before, it's really relieving to realize that you're not the only one.
You were a heroin addict, and that was probably very connected to why mm-hmm. you were doing the work and how you were doing it. I mean, I imagine the work helped paid for your drugs.
It did. But, you know, I mean, I think that a lot of people tend to assume that there was a directly sort of causal relationship between my being a heroin addict and my being a dominatrix. And that's not exactly how it sort of worked out. I didn't become a dominatrix out of desperation. It wasn't to feed my drug addiction. I really think that sort of both of those practices came from a similar place, you know, both sort of a simultaneous desire to find a way to make the world feel more manageable and to feel more in control of my own experience. And drugs are a way of feeling in control of your experience, to be able to have control over the way your environment affects you. And playing out these fantasies and playing this role where I was pursued and where I was in control also felt really safe in a certain way. And at the same time, almost paradoxically, I think that I also sort of sought out these extreme experiences because to try to manage your own human experience and to be in control of the world, essentially, to sort of try to play God is exhausting and impossible and a futile task. And I think that in seeking sort of these extreme experiences, I was sort of searching for the wall, you know, searching to find, to be sort of disproven in my own power so that I could let go of that futile task.
Don't you think in a way that the heroine deadened you enough to do the work of dominatrix, that it might have been more difficult had all your senses really been alert and not dulled or changed by heroin?
I do think so. I mean, and the experience of being a dominatrix really changed really fundamentally because I got clean while I was a dominatrix. And, you know, I assumed actually when I got clean that I would be rendered almost instantly incapable of doing it anymore because I would be really awake. And in many ways, it's true. You know, I was much more conscious during my sessions. I was much more aware of things, and it did become difficult in some ways. But it was also, to my own surprise, revealed to me that I could still do it, that there was something that kept me there, and it hadn't been the drugs, you know, that there was something else in me that brought me there, that was distinct from the drugs, because I kept doing it for over a year after I got clean.
In writing about your experience as a professional dominatrix, you write, most sessions were based on paradigms that were often a kind of inversion of misogyny, the subjugation of women reenacted by men on themselves. Our clients wanted to be dressed in women's clothing and raped, molested, infantilized, humiliated, and physically abused. Can you talk about that a little more, this idea of it being like an inversion of misogyny?
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't dig very deep into my observations of that when I first started. You know, it seemed pretty clear to me. I am acting out a powerful role. I can be a feminist and also dress up in these sexy clothes and enjoy being desired. And that seemed to agree for me. But the longer that I worked in the job, the more I sort of recognized this sort of inversion of sexual paradigms. And it was disturbing. And I didn't quite know what to make of it. And I still don't quite know what to make of it. But I don't think that it's as simple as I thought in the beginning, where it was sort of like, you know, good. These are men who want to get a taste of their own medicine, you know. But also I was being paid to to still conform to these fantasies. And in some ways, it started to dawn on me that even if it was being performed on the men themselves, it was still sort of reinforcing these kinds of behaviors, you know, and it was still an obsession with misogyny and with sort of the abuse of female characters. They just happened to be men dressed up as women. And also, I mean, I don't have an answer for this or a diagnosis for it, but it occurred to me then and it occurs to me now that it might also be an expression of men's discomfort with those paradigms in our culture, you know, and trying to make sense of it themselves, you know.
But even when you're the dominatrix and you're the one in power and you're humiliating the man, it's in some ways still the man who's in control. He's paying for you. If you perform well, he'll give you a big tip, and if you don't, he won't. I mean, he kind of wrote the play, and you're an actress in it.
Exactly. And that became progressively less and less comfortable for me the longer that I was in the job. And I mean, it in the beginning, it did feel pretty powerful, you know, to act out those roles. And in the end, not even in the end, after a little while, you know, it wasn't my fantasy in most cases, you know. And in a lot of ways, it felt more humiliating to me than it did to them. I mean, I think it was satisfying for them. And for me, to enact a sexual fantasy that wasn't my own fantasy was uncomfortable in a lot of ways. And especially after I got clean, became acutely uncomfortable in many ways. And as much as I had sort of my own arguments and ideology and rationalizations about it, like my emotional experience, which I slowly sort of awoke more and more to throughout my time doing it, my authentic emotional experience was that it ended up being kind of humiliating for me in a lot of sessions. Not all, but in many of them.
Now, I am looking at your resume. and it has how you got your MFA at Sarah Lawrence College. It has how you were the recipient of the Outstanding Faculty Member of the Year Award in 2008, 2009. What it doesn't have is that you were a dominatrix for 4 years.
No.
Did you intentionally leave that off the resume?
Yeah, I hadn't. I haven't typically thought of it as sort of a boon when job, you know, I'm looking for a full-time faculty position right now. And, you know, it's really, this is actually something that I've been dealing with a lot very recently. You know, my book just came out on Tuesday. And I mean, typically having been a sex worker or a dominatrix or participating, you know, being a former heroin junkie, they're not things that you talk about with your colleagues at work, especially in academia. But I've sort of merged my checkered past and my most extreme personal experiences, the kinds of things that most people don't tell anyone about, with my career and with my profession and with my artistic craft. And so it's a really interesting adventure, and also a challenge. You know, I'm not always sure how to navigate it. You know, I was recently at a faculty meeting congratulated by my boss at Purchase for I was on the cover of the New York Post. You know, and it was like, thank you. But I also, it was an awkward moment, you know, because you're not used to accepting congratulations for having had these kinds of experiences. But ultimately, I'm really glad for it. And I'm really glad to be able to sort of present these experiences in conjunction with my creative processing, with literature and with my teaching, because I do see them. They're not things to be ashamed of. You know, maybe in our culture at large, they are, but they've really profoundly enriched me and deepened me as a human being and as an intellectual and as a teacher and absolutely as a writer.
Melissa Phoebos, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's been a huge pleasure.
Melissa Phoebos is now an assistant professor of English at Utica College. Her memoir, Whip Smart, is now out in paperback. Lyricist Fran Landsman, who wrote the words for the jazz classic Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most, died Saturday at the age of 83. She wrote for decades and performed until the week of her death, but she was never as well known as some of her songs, which also include Ballad of the Sad Young Men and Small Day Tomorrow. Landsman was part of a circle of beat writers and jazz musicians when she started writing songs in the early 50s. She married Jay Landsman in 1950, and they opened the famed Crystal Palace nightclub in St. Louis. where Woody Allen, Lenny Bruce, and Barbara Streisand made early appearances. They later moved to London. For a period, the couple became known as much for their open marriage and bohemian lifestyle as for their professional accomplishments. Jay Lantzman died earlier this year. Terry Gross interviewed Fran Lantzman in 1988. Before we hear that conversation, here's one of the definitive recordings of Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most, sung by Betty Carter. The music is by Tommy Wolfe.
Spring, it's here. Has got me feeling like a horse that never left the post. I lie in my room, staring up the ceiling. Spring can really hang you up the most.
I wrote that song because I was enamored of T.S. Eliot's poem, which begins, April is the cruelest month, mixing memory with desire, breeding lilacs out of the deadland. And I was thinking to myself, if a hipster were going to say that, he would say, spring can really hang you up the most, man. And I told that to this piano player, Tommy Wolfe, and he said, that would make a good song. Why don't you try to write it? And I said, I've never written a song. He said, oh, go ahead and try. So I brought this lyric into him, and he put that beautiful, beautiful music to it.
So this was the very first song you wrote.
Yeah.
You collaborated on it with Tom Wolfe, who you wrote a lot of songs with. How did you first start to collaborate with him?
Well, we had this bar, and he was the piano player. And I used to sit on the piano bench with him and say, you know, go over old songs and things. And then when I came up with that idea for a song, Spring Could Really Hang You Up the Most, and he said he'd put a tune to it. Well, after that, we just did more and more. I'd do two or three a week.
We had this bar. You owned the bar?
Yes, yes.
I see. So you'd sit and sing with him?
Well, I didn't sing in those days. Tommy put me off the idea of singing because he was so bitchy about girl singers. He was always complaining about how they couldn't keep time and they were singing out of tune. And I didn't want people talking like that about me. So therefore, I didn't want to sing. But the musicians say to me now, they say, but we like the way you sing because we know you're a writer. We just don't like singers who can't sing.
Many of the lyrics that you've written, especially the ones from the 1950s, have real hipster lyrics. I'm thinking especially of some of the songs in The Nervous Set, which was a musical that you co-wrote with Tom Wolfe, and your husband Jay Lantzman wrote the book for it.
Let's just have fun, let's dig the happenings. This world is weird and full of crazy things. Shakespeare was a hack, so we read Kerouac. Baby, let's just have fun.
All the hipster lyrics that you wrote, I always wanted to know if you spoke hip at the time, if you used any of the lingo that you used in the lyrics.
It's funny. Actually, Tommy Wolfe introduced me to that language, and I was just fascinated about, I mean, he was the first person I ever heard refer to a man as a cool stud. And I thought, what a perfect description of this particular guy, but alas, I found out that actually cool just meant nice, and he called all guys studs. And I decided that since so few men were studs, and of the few who were studs, few of them were cool, it was a pity that he didn't realize he had so aptly described this person.
Do you feel a connection to lyricists like Ira Gershwin, Larry Hart, Noel Coward, Cole Porter?
Gosh, I hope so. You know, when we did The Nervous Set on Broadway, there was a line in a song, no matter how they rave now, Larry Hart is in his grave now, and whoever takes Manhattan as a square. And Richard Rodgers came to see the show, and he said, you know, people have been calling me up all week. They're so furious about that. He said, but I knew you kids didn't mean to knock Larry. And I said, are you kidding? He was my hero. I wasn't knocking him. I was just saying that perhaps that song has been overdone now.
Songwriting has, like many other fields, always been a very male world, especially until recently. The beat circle that you hung out with, the writers, musicians, painters, though they were mostly men, too.
And they weren't interested in women for doing anything but emptying the ashtrays. As a matter of fact, the other night, Allen Ginsberg came up to me after the gig and said that he really liked a poem of mine. And it's the first time, I just felt that he was never even aware that I did anything. So I was really thrilled.
One of the things I really like about your songs is your sense of wordplay and your sense of humor.
Some of my songs are funny. As a matter of fact, somebody told me recently that I'm known as the Queen of Sad, and I don't think it's fair because I like to think that all of my songs are both sad and funny.
One of the songs that probably comes to mind when people call you the Queen of Sad is The Ballad of the Sad Young Man.
Yes, exactly.
All the sad young men seek a certain smile, someone they can hold for a little while. Tired little girl does the best she can, trying to be gay for a sad young man.
Tell me the story behind writing that song.
A friend of ours, we were in St. Louis, and we had a bunch of pals who used to hang out in P.J. Clark's, and we were talking long distance to them, and I heard that one of them had gotten engaged to a 16-year-old girl. And I thought, that poor girl, she doesn't stand a chance, because those guys really hang out in those bars. And they're, you know, that's, I think I wrote the verse about tired little girl does the best she can, trying to be gay for a sad young man. I think that was the beginning of the song, and then the rest of it grew up around it. But the weird thing is that people think now that it's a song about gay people.
That's right, about gay men.
Because when I wrote that song, it simply meant lively. Trying to cheer him up, not trying to be bisexual.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a new song you can read for us?
This is the last one. This is a sad, funny song. It's called Goodbye to All That. Goodbye days of jazz and joking. Goodbye booze and food that's fried. Goodbye glamour, so long smoking. Hello, thoughts of suicide. Farewell days of fun and flirting. Goodbye sex. So glad we came. Now there's always something hurting. Hello, specs and walking frame. So long, lovely finger lickers. Goodbye, life that late we led. Hello, cramps and dodgy tickers. Soon we'll be the grateful dead. Goodbye, Lenny. Goodbye, Ronnie. Goodbye, pretty girls and boys. Goodbye, Shirley. Goodbye, Johnny. Hello, geriatric joys.
Now, you read that at a gathering of old friends to celebrate the work of John Cleland Holmes, who's had some work republished. Now, at this party, I think, was Allen Ginsberg, David Amram, Larry Rivers.
All of them.
Herbert Hunke. What kind of reaction did you get to this poem?
They all liked it so much. I was so nervous because I kept thinking, what is this going to be, cabaret or a funeral? And also the fact that my stuff sort of rhymes the way it does, and all those boys are free verses. I wasn't sure. They really did like it.
Lyricist Fran Landsman speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Landsman died Saturday at the age of 83. Here's Ella Fitzgerald singing Fran Landsman's best-known song.
Love came my way, I hoped it would last. We had our day, now that's all in the past. Spring came along, a season of song, full of sweet promise, but something went wrong. Doctors once prescribed a tonic, sulfur and molasses was the dose. Didn't help a bit. condition must be chronic. Spring can really hang you up the most. All alone, the party's over. Old man Winter was a gracious host. But when you keep praying for snow to hide the clover, spring can really hang you up the most.
The title and poster for the new film Cowboys and Aliens have been getting people excited for nearly a year, and it's finally here. Directed by Jon Favreau of Iron Man and starring Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford. There's another alien invasion movie opening today called Attack the Block, which is a low-budget film from Britain. Film critic David Edelstein reviews them both.
The sci-fi western Cowboys and Aliens has something for everyone, and not enough for anyone. I couldn't help thinking of the missed opportunities to play with two such disparate American genres. That said, Jon Favreau is a crafty director. He adds suspense to a bland story by withholding all the pertinent details, keeping us in a happy state of anticipation. It starts with a start. Rugged, blue-eyed Daniel Craig wakes up in the desert with a wound in his side, a metallic bracelet on his wrist, and no memory, though he does have super fighting skills. He's haunted, but by what? He walks through the swinging door of a saloon in a failed gold mining town and drinks to ease the pain. But being a Western hero, he's soon punching out rich bully Paul Dano, who's beating up mousy saloon keeper Sam Rockwell. Then Dano's daddy, a baleful Harrison Ford, shows up with his men, and it looks like they'll be shooting until, what the heck? The camera makes like Spielberg's, tracking in on characters gazing at a glow on the horizon that turns out to be little ships that whiz in and snatch up screaming earthlings. No spoilers, folks. But nothing brings folks together like aliens. The outlaw, the greedy capitalist boss, and even the Native American chief are now on the same side. Too bad those aliens are a massive disappointment. Their ships clearly computer-generated and too fast to generate much awe. The CGI ETs, apart from one Nazi-like surgeon, anonymous. The cowboys get the screen time, sometimes too much. Rumor has it Ford insists on having his parts beefed up, so even with a supporting role, he has draggy scenes in which he gruffly bonds with the sheriff's grandson and acts racist toward his Native American top man, Adam Beach. Gorgeous, cat-eyed Olivia Wilde stands around as a woman who, what on earth is she doing? In Cowboys and Aliens, not knowing is more fun than finding out. The low-budget British film Attack the Block has what's missing from Cowboys and Aliens. It's wall-to-wall sci-fi pop culture bric-a-brac, yet feels homegrown. The gang of hooligans, mostly black, live in a South London project and mug a white nurse played by Jodie Whittaker. So it's neighbor against neighbor, until the creatures plummet to earth. One kid describes them as looking like a monkey crossed with a fish, and they have iridescent fangs that rip people to shreds. Dig these great accents as the teens decide how to take on the invaders.
What is that, cuz?
That's an alien, bruv. Believe it. And I landed in the wrong place, though. You get the wrong place.
As leader of the gang, John Boyega has the poise of Denzel Washington and a gift for playing three things at once: pride, courage, and fear. He can't be shown up, which is why he chases down the first little alien that lands, kills it, and carries it on a stick like a trophy. It's only later he understands his macho instinct for revenge has indirectly caused much of the carnage. But not all. These are nasty creatures, and there's tons of splatter. But ultimately, this is the story of kids on their own, with no authority figures who believe their story. One kid even wonders if the creatures weren't sent to kill black boys because, quote, we ain't killing each other fast enough. To defend the block, they grab ninja swords, guns, and fireworks, and teaming up now with Jodie Whittaker's nurse, prove they're made of nobler stuff. Attack the Block was written and directed by Joe Cornish, and the executive producer was Edgar Wright, who made Shaun of the Dead. Cornish, like Wright, uses genre parody and homage not to deflate his material, but rethink and revitalize it. Unlike the colossally budgeted Cowboys and Aliens, you don't come out of this one thinking, I wonder how much that cost.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.